Well, I hope everybody saw the eclipse this week. Did you? Yeah. I had no idea what it was like to be in the path of totality. That was my first time to experience that. It's pretty awesome. I was here on church property with the Good Neighbor team for the eclipse. And in less than 3 minutes, we have it documented. We took photographs. Wayne took photographs. In less than 3 minutes, we went from a good amount of light to certain darkness. And the night security lights here on the property came on, and some large birds came out from the trees on the property. I don't know, hawks, owls, they circled above us as we were sitting in the parking lot. My dog went to sleep. It was inspiring. Holy ground. That's our topic for today. Exodus chapter 3 is set on God's holy mountain, Mount Horeb. Or maybe more familiar, Mount Sinai. Same place, same mountain. The exact geographical location for Mount Sinai, though, is up for debate, much debate. Scholars do not agree on where to put that mountain. There have actually been 12 different locations nominated for God's holy mountain. Old Testament professor at Princeton University, Dennis Olson, wrote about mountains in the ancient Near East. They were considered to be the special dwelling places of the gods because of their height and their proximity to the heavens, because of their massive size and their enduring presence, their association with clouds and storms, and then just their simple majesty and awe. Mountains do get mentioned in the Bible. They get mentioned in the Bible pretty often. You'll remember that Jesus preaches a sermon on the mount, that the Gospels also speak of the transfiguration of Jesus happening on a mountain. There is Mount Carmel, where the prophet Elijah goes head-to-head with the prophets of Baal, and there's Mount Moriah, where Abraham thinks that he's going to sacrifice his son Isaac. Exodus chapter 3, verse 1, is the first time that the mountain of God, Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, gets mentioned. It's worth paying attention to the first time that something is mentioned in the Bible, especially if it is a person or a place of significance, because you'll probably pick up some defining characteristics of that person or place the first time that it's mentioned. Moses is shepherding a flock of sheep for his father-in-law Jethro. He's at the edge of the desert, and he comes to the base of a mountain, the foot of a mountain, where an angel appears. The angel shows up in a flame in the middle of a bush, in the middle of a shrub that burns but is not consumed. And here God's voice calls out to Moses to lead the Israelites out of slavery in Egypt. Now, the name Sinai sounds very much like the Hebrew word for bush or shrub, which is Sena, S-E-N-E-H. Sounds a lot like Sinai. And this is worth our attention. God's holy mountain, Sinai, is a play on words. This scene in Exodus chapter 3 is meant to come to mind every time that God's holy mountain gets mentioned in the Bible and in our tradition. Every time it's mentioned, we're supposed to say, ah, remember about God's holy mountain? The shrub, the bush. I love this because it makes the place where God dwells, of course, holy and set apart and captivating and powerful and approachable and common and humble, a mountain and a shrub. The thing about a shrub is that a shrub is just a shrub, right? There's nothing to be proud of here. There's nothing elevated or impressive about a regular old bush. It's not a pomegranate tree or an olive tree, or an almond tree. This is just a desert shrub. You know, I think tumbleweed, but I'm from West Texas. You should think whatever you have too much of. What shrub, what brush do you have too much of? Is it cedar? Yeah. Well, that is a place where God could move in. Yeah. In most religions, the place where God resides is an intimidating place. But in our Bible, in our tradition, there's this combination of majesty and mundane that I think is very important. At the base of a mountain, a shrub. By the way, the last major biblical appearance of Mount Sinai happens in 1 Kings chapter 19, where the prophet Elijah witnesses these great signs of power in the wind, and in an earthquake, and in the flame. But God is not present in any of those displays of power. Instead, God passes by in the sheer sound of silence, reassuring Elijah to go back to doing what he was doing. Go back to being a prophetic voice. Go back to your prophetic work. You see, the power of God's call, it is never in direct demands or threats. Don't let anybody fool you into thinking that's God's voice, a threat or a demand. God's call is made real and very powerful when we turn aside and receive it. When we open ourselves up to divine invitation, to divine intention. That's where God's power resides. Reverence is what preacher Barbara Brown Taylor calls turning aside. And she claims that reverence or paying attention is the thing that makes Moses, Moses. His ability to park the sheep and leave the narrow path to get closer to this marvelous light on the side of the road. And when he does this, God notices that Moses turns aside, and then God dismisses the angel in the shrub and takes up residence there to speak to Moses. Listen to verse 4 of chapter 3 again. When the Lord saw that Moses was coming to look, God called to him out of the bush, "Moses, Moses." And Moses said, "I'm here." The NRSV says, when the Lord saw that Moses turned aside to see. You see, this is the practice of turning aside. On Thursday afternoon of this week, I was walking down my driveway to make sure that the gate at the end of my driveway was open, because I knew that a friend was coming over and I didn't want her to have any troubles with the gate. There's an empty lot next door to me, and I noticed as I was walking down the driveway, out of the corner of my eye, some bright color. And because turning aside was on my mind this week, I decided to do it. To turn aside, to lean against the gate, and to really take in the bright color that was right there. There are wildflowers, still some bluebonnets, some wild daisies and milkweed. The tall grass in that lot was blowing in the breeze. And you know what? There were 30 or 40 butterflies flying around those flowers and that grass, and I would have totally missed them had I kept walking. The movement of those yellow and white butterflies, you know, just ignited the whole scene. Holy ground. St. Francis of Assisi wrote in the 1300s, "Such love does the sky pour forth that whenever I stand in a field, I have to ring out the light when I get home." I love that thought. I love that image of being drenched in God's love on holy ground. In her book, An Altar in the World, Barbara Brown Taylor said, "Most of us move so quickly that our surroundings become no more than blurred scenery that we fly past on our way to somewhere else. We pay attention to the speedometer and the wristwatch and the cell phone and the list of things to do, all of which feed our illusion that life is manageable. Meanwhile, none of those things meets the first criterion for reverence, which is to remind us that we are not gods." That's the thing about turning aside. that there really is nothing that is electronic or manufactured that can help us with reverence. So put down the cell phones and step away from the screens. Reverence is primarily a practice of stepping aside and setting down the desire to be in control. That's why Moses takes off his shoes. I've struggled with this week. Why does Moses take off his shoes? Well, of course, he doesn't have a cell phone, but his shoes are his armor. His shoes, his sandals, are his protection, the only device of control that he has. The little tanks on his feet is one way I read this week about shoes. Little tanks on your feet. Reverence always involves being vulnerable. It always involves releasing control and being vulnerable in the presence of divine humility. That's why he takes off his shoes. We don't always get taking off our shoes right, and by we, I mean preachers. Pastors are the ones who typically make a show of removing our shoes while we preach on holy ground, preaching barefoot, I think mostly for your discomfort. Sorry about that. The thing about reverence is that it's not a matter of pride, and it's never an aggressive stance. Not once in Scripture does it say, take off your shoes to set someone else straight. That's not what reverence is about. For me, preaching with my shoes off would just be fake humility. But walking from my house to the barn, barefoot, without shoes, that would be the real deal for me. Maybe someday I'll try it. Recently, I listened to theologian Brian McLaren interview his grandchildren about their love for animals, a second grade granddaughter, a fourth grade grandson who loved newts, N-E-W-T-S, and then a preteen granddaughter who is very interested in horses. This recording reminded me how easily children do reverence as they talked about their delight in these animals, their delight in God's creation. It reminded me, gosh, children just do this naturally, this thing that I'm trying to do, to be wowed by God's creation. And I think that this must have been what Jesus was after when he called his disciples to have faith like little children. Because little children can't help but be vulnerable. They are, by their very nature, vulnerable. And yet still they marvel. Still they stand in wonder. That's it. The faith of children. Reverence. Turning aside. Turn aside and risk hearing God's call to you.